hello and welcome to episode 18 of the Wilder podcast. Today we have a fascinating chat with Steve Mason, who's the Community Parks Officer at Cheltenham Borough Council. In this episode, we're talking about rewilding in semi-urban spaces, what that looks like, how to work alongside the community, and what are the benefits for people and nature alike. I am Chloe Constable, and alongside me is Tom Constable.
Hello. Now, so let's mix it up a little bit now. We thought we'd do a bit of an intro at the start, you know, so that people knew what they were getting involved in. And then we can go into our kind of preamble where we update the listener on the Grange project and all that kind of stuff. Do you think it's worked?
We'll find out, won't we?
Yeah, so a lot has happened again. Yes, again, over to now in the last episode. A bit to update on. Chloe, do you want to cover the planning side?
Well, it's not a particularly exciting update, sadly. Although we have had some nice feedback from the White Castle Community Council, which I'm not saying has anything to do with Tom's appearance at their meeting.
Very nice people, and that's all I can say.
But that's great, and it's fantastic to have the support from the local community. We're still awaiting on a consultation response, and not pointing any fingers here, but it's Natural Resources Wales that are slightly slowing things down.
So it should have closed last week, and I've requested a two-week extension, which I'm just hoping they're really busy as opposed to spending 2 weeks deciding what objections to put in there.
Slightly concerning it's gone to the specialist team.
Oh, has it? Oh, wonderful. Well, you know, that sounds ominous, but I'm sure there'll be a solution going forward, but we'll find out hopefully in another week or so.
Yeah, I'll be very sad if we can't give you a decision in 2 weeks' time next podcast. But what has taken up most of our thinking space at the moment is our Volunteers Day.
Yes, I've got to say, kudos to you, Chloe, that you've managed to organise and use WhatsApp in an innovative way.
I'm very proud of my affinity WhatsApp group. There's been a few technical mishaps along the way, but my mum's helped me out and we've got that.
To summarise, 16th of March this year, we've got a Volunteers Day that listeners of the podcast essentially have put their names forward to come and help. And we've been really happy with the response. Around about 30 people have come, which is exactly probably the right number, assuming that there or thereabouts turn up, you know, not too many because this is our first event. And the thing that's most important is make sure that our guests, volunteers, whatever, come and have a good time and leave with a positivity. You know, if it was too many people, I think that there's a risk that we couldn't kind of influence that in a positive way. But too few, we wouldn't get a lot done. So I think we're going to get just the right amount of work done. So the guests are going to arrive. But Chloe, would you like to kind of give a bit of an itinerary of what it would be like?
Gosh, and now there's pressure. Well, we have actually done some planning now, which is exciting. So they're going to arrive. We've got some baked goods and some beverages to get them started. And then those that haven't been to site before are going to have a little tour by myself of the site and what we've sort of done so far and what we're hoping and kind of the vision of the project. And then are you taking over with your health and safety briefing?
Yeah, no, we'll do that before we leave. Before we step anywhere, okay. I'm now absolutely petrified that someone...
Goggles, high vis, people are signing a disclaimer before they even move.
It's just ridiculous, but it's important because as anyone that's organised or worked with people outside of your control, the public, anything that could go wrong will probably go wrong. So I think you've just got to make sure you're always prepared for it. So yes, no, we're all, as much as I would just love it that not to be the case and we could just all come with the right attitude, and you can't assume that's going to happen. So yes, don't worry. The key thing is we're all going to be safe. The volunteers are going to be doing some awesome things with some great team leaders that have volunteered and stepped up and going to be leading on it. Tree planting, obviously, we've got a whole myriad of trees that have turned up. Chloe, you can regale us about tree guards in a second, the challenges. We're going to be doing some disturbance of the grounds. We're going to be doing brush piles and also internal fence clearing, just as a starter for 10, really. In terms of disturbance, now, this, to lots of people, may sound really stupid. To me, sound like the best idea ever. So I could go around with a pickaxe and pretend I was a wild boar, but I thought, there's a thing called a rotavator, and it's a handheld rotavator that you could, you know, go around the land and pretend to be a wild boar, but just even more efficient. So I've got one.
Shall I tell people what you came back looking like, having used it for about 3 minutes?
No, it has rained for forever, and the ground is a little bit moist, shall we say. In retrospect, may not have been the best conditions for a rotavator.
It's likely that he'd been swimming in his own sweat when he returned from the rotavator experiment.
And I think I've done my back a mischief as well. But it does actually look quite good. I walked around there this morning. So I would say the effect the rotavator achieves out of 10, 7 out of 10, okay, which is not bad. Okay. I'd say effort level, a strong 11 out of 10 anyway, but there we go.
Well, we're doing the sun dance. Come on.
We live and learn. Yeah. You live and learn. That's all I can say. So, Chloe, can you briefly wrap up the rest of the Volunteers Day before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be food involved, various cakes, lunches, a bit more activity and probably some form of debrief. But actually, the bit I'm most looking forward to is there are some people on our list who I have no idea who they are. Some people are coming from Kent, from mid Wales. I want to know how they found us, what they hope to get out of the day, what their story is. Like, I can't wait to chat to some people and make some new connections.
Yeah, ditto. So before we go into the interview for today, Chloe, I know we have been doing a lot of back and forth about trees, different types of trees, which trees, native trees, not trees, and also the infamous tree guard or not tree guard question. So come on, share your wisdom.
I feel really enlightened about this, having struggled over a few evenings to work out what we were doing and why. But I mean, I guess the first question to the debate, or arguably debate, is does tree planting form part of a rewilding project? I mean, there's a whole podcast episode in that, but some would say, and I would agree, that natural regeneration is always the best starting point. But because of the size of our fields and because the tree seed source is stuck in the hedgerows, we thought we could be looking at a couple of decades before the seed source really dispersed into the centre of the field. Hence, the need to do some tree planting, hopefully, to kickstart some of those processes. Then the question is, what trees, where, and how are you going to protect them? So clearly, we're going for native trees, which in some ways actually harder to find out than I thought, what was native and not native. But Chris de Gorn's Buy Native website was a useful resource, as well as some stuff from Natural Resources Wales. So I think I feel confident the trees that we have got are native. Then it was a question of where you buy them from. So we were advised that the Wooden Trust was a good place. And actually that fits for me because obviously all the profits go back into the charity. Now you've got your trees, how many do you buy? I mean, we went for 300 because it felt like a reasonable number in terms of we're not trying to plant a closed canopy woodland here. We just want a few clusters of trees around the site.
And also, this is our first foray into tree planting. I think some would say we're already getting too late in terms of the season. So we don't even know what 300 trees planted looks like. I think we're going to be underwhelmed by the
effect. Like at the point when the box arrived, we were like, is that 300 trees? It's like one box about the size of a small table.
Even smaller than that, yeah. So, okay, good. So now we've got the trees. We know they're native. And then what?
Well, we're looking after them, aren't we? So we're watering them to make sure they stay moist and cool.
Remind me to that after we finish this recording.
One job. And then the final question is around how do we protect said trees? Now, usefully, Rewilding Britain had just done a webinar on tree protection. So I had the pleasure of listening to a chap who was much wiser than I am on this subject, talking about all the different options for tree protection. And they've done some really cool field studies because the Woodland Trust have made a commitment to not be using any plastic guards for protection. And interestingly, what the research suggests is that the most sustainable option for tree protection is, unsurprisingly, no protection. The problem with that, where we are, is we have a lot of deer, we have a lot of rabbits. We thought that might result in dead trees. Another option is to reuse plastic guards, which sounds great in principle, but actually quite hard to source plastic guards in the area that we could reuse. So that's another challenge. Then you've got some biodegradable tree guards that come in all different flavours, sugar, this, coconut, that, cactus, that. So we have bought a couple of those to experiment with, although it was kind of, it's quite depressing that the price point of the biodegradable plastic guards is about 5 times that of the plastic. So you're talking about quite an investment, but if it's important for us to do that experiment. So we've gone for kind of an experimental approach of some biodegradable. We have gone for some plastic, but with the intention that we're going to take them off at 4 years in order to reuse them. And we're also going for nature's protection. Do you want to explain a bit more about that?
Oh, yes. Simply put, we are building brash piles, which is essentially cuttings from hedges, from fallen trees or whatever, pushing it all together to create brash piles in the middle of our fields, which will then form a natural protection for our little saplings, to be a little creche for them, to allow them to grow and also provide habitats for all sorts of different other creatures. We're really excited to see that. Obviously, the great thing, we don't have any tree guards for them. And then also, we're going to be planting some in the bracken. We've got a small patch of bracken pushing out from our stream where nature is suggesting woodland would like to be. So we're going to plant some in there. And my theory, although Chloe's probably not as convinced as me, is that bracken is there to protect it. And we'll do a good enough job without tree protection there. So that, again, that's part of this testing, is to go, how many of our saplings that we plant there survive into adulthood?
I think that's the fun thing about this. It is a giant experiment. We don't know what the outcome's going to be. I mean, we've been literally Googling brush piles, bracken, trees for the last week. We're not ecologists, but we come in with logic and an experimental mindset, and we're really excited to share the results with everyone.
Right, shall we go into the interview?
I'm excited. Let's do that.
So Stephen's interview comes with a trigger warning. We talk about rewilding, but I think rewilding, as we all know, means different things to different people. So if you are the kind of person that believes rewilding should only and purely be used on places like Yellowstone National Park with wolves, then probably You just need to ignore the word rewilding for this whole interview. It's a great interview, just ignore that word. But it's about, and we go into it, it's about context for in terms of the use for the word. So I think it's a very interesting conversation. What I like about this one is it's very relevant to almost everybody listening, because not everybody moves to the middle of nowhere and lives in a cave underground. We all live in semi-urban or urban areas, generally speaking. So what Stephen's talking about and the value that he's bringing to his town is really quite inspiring, quite exciting, and I hope people enjoy it. Steve, welcome to the Wilder Podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you for reaching out and getting involved. And we're just discussing, weren't we, offline, that you've kindly volunteered your time to come on the Volunteers Day.
I have indeed, yes.
Which was fine until I realised that you are going to be super overqualified for me trying to help talk and teach about what we're trying to do on the site. But I'm glad to have you there, certainly to make sure that we don't, the main effort is making sure we don't do things wrong.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fine. It's what we do as a department, day in, day out. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you're coming. Right. I feel like the pressure's off.
There you go.
But that is not the main effort for today. So, Steve, could you give us a bit about yourself, your background, and how you find yourself in the role that you're in now?
Yes, thank you. My name is Steve Mason. I am Parks Officer for Cheltenham Borough Council, a very beautiful town on the edge of the Cotswolds, probably about halfway between Bristol and Birmingham, very close to Gloucester, and of course the Forest of Dean and the Cotswolds and the Severn Vale. So an amazing, amazing bit of the country. I actually myself have come on a very circuitous route in that I didn't start out in an ecological career in any way. I was actually in construction, doing project management and surveying. But it got to the point where I just wanted a complete career change and to do something that I was passionate in. I've always been passionate in the wildlife, ecology, that sort of thing. It was what I did in my spare time, and I would volunteer a lot. And I thought, nope, now's the time to make that jump, as it were. And so this role came up, and I jumped at the chance. And it's the best thing I ever did. And I get to be out there in nature, wildlife, for a job. I actually get paid to do it, which is amazing.
Now, this is pure coincidence, but last episode we had talking about the Forest Dean, where we were from, and then Cheltenham is actually where I went to university. And I can definitely second your statement about how beautiful it is, because I looked at courses in Hull. Now, there's nothing wrong with Hull, but it's not quite Cheltenham. And then I looked at a course in Cheltenham and in the Park campus, which is a university campus there, quite literally is a big park. And it was very beautiful. So that was one of the reasons why I chose it. So not just picking places I've lived, but it just seems to happen that way.
So I was curious, Steve, you talked about your role as Parks Officer. I guess I was wondering what that role involves and what is the definition of a park?
Oh, what is the definition of a park? That's a good one. I guess we look after green spaces within Cheltenham, of which we have, well over 150, probably approaching 200 little bits of green space. Some of those are defined as parks, and I guess they're the more formal areas that are designated for people's use in terms of, has it got a lake? Have they got paths around them? Some of them have got sports activities, that sort of thing. But it's a really difficult one to actually answer. How do you define a park? For some people, a park would be the likes of Pitfield Park, which is a very formal place with the pump room, and that's what they see as a park.
Sorry. It's very good to run around that area. It's a good running route.
Indeed it is, yes. It's got its own park run and all sorts. And other people see some of our more wilder areas as a park. So it's, I guess it covers all things for all people.
And what's your responsibility, Steve, as Parks Officer in connecting with these green spaces?
Well, we have overall responsibility for the management of these green spaces, and I guess on behalf of the public, because they are public green spaces.
And for people that are completely naive to what that might mean, I'm guessing things that come to my head are things like cutting the grass, it needs cutting, and making sure that it's, any trees are looked after. But it'd be good to hear a bit more about what that might look like.
Yes, I mean, it's all of those things. We've got our own in-house maintenance company who go out and they do those things. They do the grass cutting and the edging and the planting and all those sorts of things to keep the parks looking as good as they can. We have a tree department who go out and look after the trees throughout Cheltenham. I mean, they're actually amazing, and they've got the right attitude in that They don't like to touch a tree unless they have to. Unless it's a safety issue, they'll just leave it to do what it wants to do. If it dies, then they'll just leave it be. Or if they have to cut it down, they'll actually leave the tree in place on the floor. So yeah, we do all sorts of things. And then we've got the public element. So we're forever fielding emails and queries from the public about what we're doing in parks and why isn't this being done? Why doesn't it look like that? And all of those sorts of things.
I was going to say, it sounds like on one hand, a dream job in terms of, you know, your role is to, yeah, that you say, look after the green spaces and be, and having spoken to your flight, you know, be innovative, be forward leaning. And that must be quite fun and quite creative. Mm. And then you've got the flip side, which is you're never going to please everyone, definitely everyone, certainly. And it's hard to please the majority, especially when sometimes my guess, and probably we'll come on to this later, but my guess is that doing the right thing for nature, inverted commas, may not be the majority right thing for the public. So how do you balance that?
That's the crux of the matter, really. I mean, you're completely right. You're never going to please everybody. It's just not going to happen. You realise that very early on in the role, that that's the case. But we try and just be out there communicating. We know what the right thing is for nature, and it's trying to balance that with the concerns and the wishes and the issues that the public have. We've still got to live in Cheltenham, and the public have got to live in Cheltenham. So it's not a case of just saying, right, we're going to rewild the whole of Cheltenham and that's it. It's having that balance, and that's the really tricky thing.
And that's coming to kind of the main effort for this chat, which is talking about, is it even possible to rewild urban or semi-urban areas, and what does that look like in practice? So before we go into that, I'd like to understand, because everyone has their own definition, what is the definition of rewilding that you are working to at Cheltenham Borough Council?
The one thing with rewilding is it has to have context. So a scheme such as NEP, that's got a completely different idea of what rewilding is and looks like and can be achieved to what the likes of yourself can achieve, and then obviously what we can do. So ours is very low level sort of touch, really. We can't go in and just rewild huge areas. We'll say, right, okay, we're going to have, you know, a herd of cows walking across Pitbull Park. it's just never going to happen. Well, that should be really nice if it did, but
that would be great.
It would be unbelievable, but it would never happen. But it's identifying those areas where we can work, we can create a bit of a dynamic habitat where we can actually introduce some level of interruption, some level of getting in there and actually changing the habitat itself. And it is trying to identify that within our parks.
I really love this idea that the definition of rewilding is context dependent. Of course, it makes complete sense. And I suppose I'm thinking about which context within Cheltenham you feel most closely aligns to kind of your hopes of rewilding.
I think it's the idea that we can introduce, we're never going to have the full trophic levels. So can we have herbivores in Cheltenham? Probably not. So we've got to take on that role. But it's allowing areas of open green spaces, parks, to be a little bit more wild, to be a little bit more messy, to do what nature wants to, how nature wants to be.
The exciting bit of this, I think, is, and the hardest bit, is the bringing the community along with you. Because if you get that influence piece right, that education piece right, where they understand why you're doing it and what they should expect to see from it, and then they start to see it, and the children, the families, and anybody sees that there's, you know, there's an impact from the work you're doing, and they can talk about it because they now understand why you've done it. That's really exciting. And I know we're going to come onto that in more detail in a second, but just stepping back slightly, so help me out here. What does rewilding in a semi-urban context look like, and what are the challenges associated with it?
So it's identifying areas within the parks. For example, in Pitbull Park, we had an area that was, it used to be back in, I remember it as a 18-hole pitch and putt course. So it closely mown, and it was an absolute sea of green desert. But a number of years ago, we decided to put a wildflower meadow in to try and increase the insect population. And that's been reasonably successful. So we identified the area where it could be carried out. And then we worked with a local organisation. We collected seed from our seed on the hill, because I don't know whether the Cheltenham Borough Council owns Leckhampton Hill, which is a SSSI/farm, about 100 or so acres.
It's another good place to go running, just saying.
It is a very good place to go running and walking. So we collected seed that we had, wildflower seed. So it was locally sourced. We knew it was right for the environment. And we've, say, we prepared the ground over a number of years. We've sown that seed, and it's really starting to bear fruit now, and it's really starting to mature. Now, to begin with, the local population, well, no, we don't want that. It looks scruffy. No, it's not right. It should all be mown. And there was a huge kickback from it, but we continued. We just told them, no, it's, you know, give it a bit of chance. And now everybody loves it. And even to the point where we mowed with the maintenance regime, we flailed the grass at the end of the season, and we get lots of emails in saying, oh, no, you've destroyed the wildflower meadow. What are you doing? And then we have to explain that, no, it's part of the management regime. And we're doing, in effect, what cows would normally do, and large herbivores, we've come in and munched the grass down. But it's worked really well.
I actually feel really inspired that people have such a connection to their green spaces, that they feel so passionate about what's going to happen with them. And then I guess it's that kind of, yeah, education piece, so that people can understand the value that's being brought, and the value to them, the value to nature, the value to their well-being of some of those changes. And I guess with that example of turning a pitch and putt course into a wildflower meadow, what consultation is involved in that? Do people have a say about what's going to happen, and where do those decisions get made? And then how do you kind of bring people along on the journey?
Yeah, they do have a say. So we put out consultation with the local friends group. There's a big friends group associated with the park, so we'd get them involved. We'd do some consultation maybe online, and then also we'd have a website set up explaining exactly what we're looking to do, and what the benefits will be, the fact that it's not going to be overnight. So, you know, you've got to just run with it. It might look a little bit scruffier for a while, and it will ultimately look a little bit more scruffier than definitely what it used to be. But these are the benefits. This is why we're trying to do it. And to be fair, most people do go with the journey. It takes a little bit of time, but yeah, most people can see the benefit, and they certainly can now. I mean, if you go back to when it was a pitch and putt, and if you'd walked across it, it would have just been deathly silent. Whereas you walk through the meadow now and it's absolutely alive with everything. You can hear the crickets and the insects and the birds. And people recognise that, and they really come on board with it.
That's great. And I can really, as you're talking, I can really picture that shift in the noise levels and what that feels like to be part of that space. And I'm guessing wondering, because Tom and I always have an eye to how do we engage those that aren't already engaged? And I'm wondering, do you have any signs up in the park itself for people that might just be on their morning jog to explain a bit about what's happening and why?
Yes, we do. Yes. So we've, during the process, when we were first carrying it out, we had some small signs put up explaining, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it. And then now it's becoming more established and people will recognise it. We've got a permanent interpretation board sign just by the meadow that actually is on one of the good running routes, that people can notice as they walk past and think, oh, I wonder what that is. And they can go and have a look, and it's got all the information about the meadow, what they're likely to see, what they could see. And we're hoping that it will entice those people into the area and interact with it a bit more.
Always looking to innovate. What about putting a scannable barcode on that with a recorded chat or podcast, just saying, episode about it? So when they're on their walk around, they can scan it and listen to the chat about what's being done there and why.
It's just, yeah, 100%. We're really starting to use QR codes now, and that's the big thing for us. It's a relatively new thing for us, because obviously, like most councils, we're probably a fair few years behind when it comes to innovation. But yes, we are doing that, and it's really working well. At the moment, it just links with websites, but it gives people a bit more information behind it.
The key thing for that is you can track it, right? So you can really understand who's listened to it or who's been visited on that. So you can work out, really understand the impact of the barcodes or the QR codes that you've suggested. Right.
Yeah.
I'm going off piste here.
I was about to say, Tom, always any opportunity to slip in a tech innovation in the building. Well, I guess thinking of maybe going back to some more of the physical, natural processes that we think about with rewilding. So it's great to hear about the kind of wildflower meadow, but I'm wondering about what other examples there are about how you've utilised rewilding principles within these semi-urban environments.
Yep. So I've recently been involved, or it was sort of my brainchild, I suppose, putting in a traditional orchard on the south side of Cheltenham. So there was an old, very overgrown orchard, the remnants of. So I've put together a little team. We've gone in, again, lots of consultation with the local residents, who are very passionate about the area, what can and can't be done to it. But we've got them on board, and we've done things like, yes, we planted some orchard trees, some fruit trees, a mix of apples, some older varieties, plums, cherries. But we've also mimicked rooting boar picks. So we've gone in and just created a little scrape, and we've gone in and just disturbed the soil. Luckily, that Weaver's Field, which is where it's situated, is the sort of place where you can do that sort of thing. Not all of the parks, you could actually just go in and start churning up the soil. Much as I'd like to, it just wouldn't be acceptable. This is one of these places where you can do it, and it's amazing fun. And a lot of people come up to me and they say, so what's going to grow there? You know, what's going to happen to it? I don't know. Yeah. I just shrug my shoulders and say, well, I'm not in control of that. If nature decides that it, you know, certain thing wants to grow there, great. If it doesn't, well, okay, I'll try it somewhere else. It's just that big slight step into the unknown, but it's exciting.
For that site specifically, who's going to have, is that a public access site? So, you know, you're going to have people in 15 years time, whatever, going through there and picking the fruit as and when and at need?
That is 100% the idea, yes. So we've created a little community orchard group who will look after it. And I can sort of bring them along on my journey. But yes, so it's a completely accessible area, accessible 24/7. So yeah, hopefully in 10, 15 years time, yes, people will walk through and they'll be able to pick apples and plums and whatever else we plant. So yeah, 100%. I just want that area to be used as an access and maybe that first step into rewilding, because for a lot of people, they don't quite understand what rewilding means to them. You know, you've probably done it. You Google rewilding and you get lots of images of wolves and lynxes and bison. And people think, well, how does that relate to me? And it's that connection. So if this actually, okay, it's only a tentative step, but if it gets them beginning to think about and understanding rewilding, then that's absolutely great and exactly what we want.
I love the idea of community orchards because it's one of those wins for everybody. They're amazing, obviously, for nature. And I hadn't, until I started learning about the role orchards play in the ecosystem, how important they are for such a wide variety of species. But then they're also obviously important for humans too, because we get the fruit to eat. And it's lovely that you can kind of engage the community. And then, yeah, what a perfect way to introduce something like a scrape alongside that project. So yeah, it's really fantastic to hear about that. And what was it about that unique site that enabled you to be able to be slightly more experimental in some of the approach that you were taking?
Well, luckily it's as the name suggests, Weaver's Field, it's a field. So it isn't an area where we go in and heavily manage. You know, at the moment, basically, it's just a case of going in once a year and cutting the grass and taking a hay crop almost off of it. So it's that little bit more wilder area. It's not a pitbull park. It's not an Imperial Gardens where it's absolutely heavily managed and you just couldn't put a scrape in there. It's that little bit more wilder area. And it's really exciting.
And I'm going into territory of which Chloe is far more qualified than I am for this one, but it strikes me that the either primary or secondary benefit of this is, it, I hope and believe, is going to be the humans benefiting from this, and humans are involved in this whole process from start to finish, especially because it's not your NEPs where nature manages it itself in a kind of a 360 circle. The smaller you get, our 80 acres, then there's obviously intervention we have to do on a fairly regular basis. And then we come down to semi-urban and it becomes pretty intensive still to manage it. But I'm curious as to know whether or not you are conducting research into the levels of the impact this will have on the local community from maybe a mental health perspective, from a community engagement perspective. Are there any metrics you're looking at?
There is something that we definitely want to start doing, because I think this is absolutely key. We all know from the COVID lockdowns where parks and green spaces, and we saw a huge uptake in the use of ours during those period, our parks, that they were absolutely vital, and people began to realise that that was the case. And yes, at the moment we've got anecdotal evidence that the groups we take into these areas, the volunteer groups, they all come out absolutely buzzing and absolutely loving it and feeling 100% refreshed and in tune. But it is something that we want to work with a few organisations to maybe actually put some solid data behind that.
I know a really good psychologist that can help get involved in that.
Get me started, Steve. Like, I'm very hard. I think it'd be amazing because, yeah, I've worked in child and adolescent mental health in Cheltenham for a number of years. And I think if we could have got some young people out connecting with nature in their local spaces, that would probably have had far more benefit than the therapy I was trying to do with them sitting in a NHS room talking about their feelings. So I think that sounds amazing. In other ways of kind of engaging people, are they getting involved with baseline surveying, monitoring the increase in diversity, etc.?
Yes, so we've started up a citizen science project throughout some of our green spaces. Yes, we are using professional ecologists to do some of the surveys. We're doing a lot of these volunteer organisations who are absolutely amazing at what they do. The likes of the Butterfly Conservation, for example, they go in and they'll quite happily spend hours and hours doing a butterfly survey, moth surveys, all sorts. And they are fantastic. But I also want to bring along the local residents to get them involved in it as well. We started off with something as simple as, we've said, if ever you see anything in any of the parks or the green spaces that looks different, look, you're interested in, just take a photo and email it up to our Facebook page. We've done that, for example, in Weaver's Field, and people have started to take photos. Now, a lot of that is going to be some fairly sort of standard mundane stuff that we know is there. But it's interesting to see how that moves with the seasons and then how the seasons are moving. It might be that you've got a plant there that flowers, some of the vetches, for example, that come out, they're coming out at different times of the year. It'd be interesting to have some data behind that as well, just to see how that moves.
I also want to stick up for the people who send in the standard and mundane images, because that is literally where I'm at with this. And I think, you know, it becomes standard and mundane for people who are in the know, but actually if they've got excited by it, that's really nice. If someone's actually got so excited by it, could be the most mundane thing in the world, but actually put the effort to send it to you, and you could reply back with, this is what it is, here's some facts about it, or here's the link to our page about them and the benefits, like, that's going to help that engagement. And next time they go for a walk and they see it, they'll tell their friend, who then shares their knowledge, and that's really exciting. And I also want to say that Chloe completely undervalued all the work she would do for 10 years at CAMHS NHS in terms of the value that the whole team are doing there. I've been speaking to them for 10 years alongside Chloe, obviously getting to know all the people, and they will do an amazing job. I think it's just that additional value of doing it in nature would be really exciting. I'm guessing is what you're saying.
Yeah, and lots of exciting developments in terms of ecotherapy and also in terms of green prescribing, which is getting people out into nature. I think there's a recognition of the value of a kind of green NHS alongside traditional ways of working.
Yeah, if we can help to facilitate that and provide those, if you like, almost like a green open air classroom, then that's exactly what we're looking
for. Could you imagine just having kids sat there and like a butterfly flutters and lands on their books or iPads or whatever they've got, I don't know, these days?
that's my dream. Yeah, I'm working again, we're going back to Weaver's Field, but I'm working with a number of the local schools in the area saying, look, this resource is there for you to use. Bring a class there and just have a class, you know, within the orchard. Can you imagine? I mean, I wouldn't even have dreamed of that when I was at school, but that would just be amazing.
And there are so many benefits to that. Tom and I were talking the other day about how many young people now would know what time of year an apple is in season, that you could pick a fresh apple. And actually, if you're engaging in a learning event or a wellbeing event within the orchard, then you get the education. But also, you know, how many of us have apple trees in our garden that perhaps we get too many apples, we don't know what to do with them, or we've got quite a lot of apple juice still in the freezer to catch from last year. But the benefits of it being community driven is that the community can then share with the harvest, and that becomes a community event of bringing people together alongside that, and that has more benefits. So what's not to like about community orchards?
We're getting really excited. I think this is another wonderful episode that could go on for hours, but I'm going to try and bring it back slightly to just understanding a few more things. I know there's more to come here around rewilding, in inverted commas, actions that can be taken in urban environments. Could you give me a couple more examples of what you've done there?
One of our really exciting projects is Griffiths Avenue Nature Reserve. It's a small little nature reserve, completely surrounded by housing, very close to the train station, right in the middle of Cheltenham. And it's just this absolute oasis of green and calm, and going back to getting people out and the health benefits, it really is. It ticks all the boxes on that front. But what we've done in there, we've done exciting things like we've veteranized a tree in there, which I hadn't heard of until recently. And I saw a few sort of YouTube clip, and we started talking about it in the office. We've got to have a go at this. This sounds amazing. So we'd always earmark this sycamore because it was getting too big. It was crowding out a lot of the light. We were trying to get some light to the woodland floor. So we sort of thought, well, okay, we're going to have to take a fair chunk of it down. But using the veteranization principles, we didn't just do that. We broke some of the limbs as they were cut down to give different habitat, almost mimicking a windstorm damage. We created bat holes in there so the arboriculturalist would take his chainsaw, cut a little chunk out, cut the back off of it, make a little entrance, and hopefully that will be used by bats. We had some bird boxes sort of made and formed within the tree. And the other day I was walking around there and there is a couple of blue ticks which seem to have taken up residence in one of the bird boxes. So it is bearing fruit already. We mimicked squirrel damage on it. All sorts. We were just really having fun. You know, we told the guys who did it, the contractors, we just said, look, just have a bit of fun with this, play around with it. And all they did, they really did. But no, it's fantastic. What we aim to do is to carry out, again, going back to these surveys, is to carry out a survey in a few years' time to say, okay, we've carried out this intervention. We've carried out this work. Has it actually worked?
Yeah.
Because it's not the sort of thing that you can easily see. Yes, you can see birds going in and out of the box, but all of those other things, all of the other micro habitats that it's created for the fungi, for invertebrates, we want to really get up there and see, yes, and prove to ourselves that yes, it has made a difference. So that'll be in the coming years.
Have you created a website, or is there a page, or are there images you could send of before and after? Because I'd love to, well, firstly, attach it to the show notes if that's allowed and if you have them.
Yes, we have. Yes, a small pamphlet was created, almost just like a Word document, really, just showing the work as it was progressing and what we've done. So yeah, more than happy for you to attach that.
Well, like you say, it is fun and it is about trying new techniques, and that is exciting because it's innovation. But I like the fact you're not just doing it. You've got that extra, let's share the knowledge, and not just share the knowledge, but also share the research and the outcomes, so that people then can take that, like you took the YouTube video and implemented it. Now they can take the findings from yours with a bit more confidence and move forward with it. It's cool. Mm,
yeah, just get out there and have a go.
So any other examples, Steve, to share with us around how you've used some of these principles in practice?
Yeah, so we've got some areas where we haven't got a tree that's readily available to veterinize. We haven't got an area where realistically we can put scrapes in or start digging up the ground. So we try and create where we can, even in the small areas, a mosaic of habitat. So we might have an area which is heavily brambled. So we might go in and say, cut a third down, right, complete to the floor. And maybe some of it will trim a little bit down and we'll let it grow back. And we'll try and create that dynamic habitat where things are always constantly changing, because that then really does, you know, the biodiversity really then starts to fly when you do that sort of thing.
No, I love that word, mosaic of habitats, because it really creates a really powerful visual image of what we're trying to create and how that differs from a heavily mown parkland or the green desert we have here in our fields.
Yeah, the thing that a lot of the community have trouble with is the dynamic nature of it. A lot of people like to see, for example, a heavily mown area or indeed a brambled area, and it's got to remain like that. You can't touch it. No. That area there is for nature, and you can't cut it down. You can't do anything with it. Whereas we're trying now to get out and to communicate and say, no, it needs to be dynamic. You can't just leave it as it is. That's not how nature works. We need to be those keystone species, those herbivores, going in and mimicking the munching of an area and heavily grazing it down. And then we'll leave it for a bit and allow it to come back up, and all those different types of flowers and foliage will just appear.
As you're speaking, Steve, it's connecting for me with, so Chris de Gordon talks about the three Ds of rewilding. So diversity and disturbance, which we were just touching on, kind of cutting things back. And then he also talks about dispersal, and often that connects to the idea of kind of wildlife corridors, and is much easier obviously on a larger scale rewilding project. So I'm wondering about how you kind of address that challenge within a semi-urban rewilding context.
Yeah, it is a difficult one, but what we're trying to do is to create Cheltenham as a porous town in terms of wildlife and movement through it. Obviously, the heavier the built-up area, the more difficult that's going to be. Luckily, with Cheltenham, as I said, we are a semi-urban area, so we do have some quite nice corridors going through. So what we're trying to do is to create these biodiversity hotspots, the likes of the Weaver's Fields, the area of the Wildflower Meadows, the Griffiths Avenues, and then begin to see how we can actually connect them up. There are some routes of old railway lines we've got in Cheltenham, which we can use as a connectivity route. We are very lucky in Cheltenham that we have a lot of very mature street trees that we can use and build up this picture of how wildlife can move through the town. It's absolutely key, I think, to the long-term success of rewilding as a whole in England and Wales and Scotland.
Okay, well, again, we're looking like we're coming to the end and these things go sadly all too fast. But I'm interested to hear from you, obviously, as one of the architects of this vision. What would success look like to you, and kind of what kind of time frames would you be hoping to see it in?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I guess time frame wise, probably the next, certainly it's going to take at least 5 years, I would think, and to start to see the fruits coming through, and are these areas really rewilding in a meaningful sense? My vision is I'd like to rewild the population of Cheltenham. Not just the landscape. I would like to, for people to understand what rewilding is, not be afraid of it, be engaged with it. And then perhaps through that, we can actually meaningfully increase the rewilding throughout the country. It's going to take a long time, and it's going to take a lot of communication and consultation, bringing them along in the journey. As I say, it's going to take at least 5 years to start to see fruits, but yeah, 100%, that's my vision.
It's that marketing and PR element that I think that is missed off, because it's a hard thing to quantify and show a return on investment, but it is as important as doing the act is communicating the act. And I just think that you need people who understand how to implement those tools on a wider basis to hit the demographics that wouldn't maybe necessarily be part of the Friends network or whatever. They're already on board. They kind of get it. I mean, you may have to still communicate why you're not doing exactly what they say or have done for the last 10 years, but it's still there on board. It's the people who aren't part of those networks. How do you reach them in a meaningful way that will drive that understanding? And I won't try and suggest there's an answer to that or an easy answer.
It's almost like, Tom, you're trying to talk both of us into a job. You're going to do the marketing and I'm going to do the evaluation from the psychological perspective and we'll be sorted.
Look, Chloe, you've got to make money where it is. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful. And hearing your passion come through is really inspiring. It's nice to see. I know that Cheltenham has always been a kind of a nature forward leaning organization, at least from when I was there. You could just tell when you walked around the place, there was a lot of pride taken with that. But I think it's moving in the right direction with the concept of looking at not only how do we make nature look pretty, it's how do we make sure that we have functional spaces that are pretty in equal measures, but also restoring nature and also helping to, inverted commas, rewild the people, help with mental health and stuff. So it's a really cool, holistic concept.
Cool. No, I've really enjoyed it. And if anybody takes anything from this, embrace the bit of messiness. It doesn't have to look absolutely 100% neat.
So. Thank you very much.
What was really interesting in that interview for me is what I've been left with is a sense of wanting to visit some of these places that he described. And I don't think that's necessarily because I'm super passionate about what a community orchard looks like, but I feel the story now. I feel the story of how it came about. I feel the story of how people engage with the process. And I feel like I want to kind of experience that story in person.
It's a spa town. It's a beautiful place. Great restaurant.
Oh, you sound like this officer.
Michelin star Indian restaurants there. It's brilliant. And also, of course, the community orchards.
But alongside that, I think building on the point that you made before the interview, is there something so valuable about a conversation where most of our listeners, I hope, would have a sense of, well, I could get involved in that, or I could do this. Actually thinking about, okay, what would it look like within my local park if we were to set aside more spaces for nature? And how would I go about influencing that conversation? I feel that's the kind of my greatest takeaways. I hope that other people feel inspired to think about how they could influence at their community level.
Yeah, I don't want to be the old, let's look at technology and digital stuff drumbeater here, but one of the things that, other than obviously Stephen's passion, which I thought was great, that maybe is being missed is that obviously Stephen has those QR codes that go to a web page, but I just feel like that is still, I'd call that dated now. Do people sit on web pages now, scroll through reams of data or words, or do they want that either engageable videos or audio content that people can kind of share and appreciate and enjoy it and learn from in the way that people want to engage with media these days? That's for me the bit that I want to make sure we don't miss. It's all well and good doing the good work, but it's more important, I would argue, that making sure we're reaching more people about the good work we're doing.
Self-marketing.
I'm just saying. Just because I'm a marketeer doesn't mean that I'm wrong, Chloe.
No, I fundamentally agree with you.
Oh, sorry, say that again. I think I might record that and just play it back when I get to bed.
You almost imply that we have quite a lot of disagreements in this family.
I think we have a healthy debate culture.
And I guess, okay, I'm going to go to the opposite end of the spectrum and just to spite that comment.
Oh, well, I'm not shocked.
I guess to me, one of the final images I'm left with is a sunny October afternoon, the community going down to the community orchards, a sense of the diversity and wildness of nature around them, picking the apples together. Perhaps there's a little apple press on the go. There's some juice. People are chatting in a kind of informal way, producing a product together that means something. Someone brings out an apple crumble with the apples from last year. And I just, for me, I know it's a kind of, maybe it's a bit of a nostalgic image, but I think that's what we need to be privileging as we move forward. No,
absolutely. And in your scenario, there's 20 or 30, which is nice. Now, in my scenario, there's like 100 or 150. It's just the same thing, but better. Well, my final thought before we wrap up this episode, from my perspective, is Stephen's bravery to do things like veteranizing a tree in the middle of a town where you are inviting feedback. It is challenging for anybody. And the fact that he's got so much passion still, always looking to learn more, to use that knowledge for the better, and then to share that with other people in the community is inspiring, like I said before. Really exciting. And I just hope there are as many or more people like him around who will do the brave thing, not just the easy thing, to continue to do the right thing for society and for nature.
I just feel excited about what British parks could look like in 5-10 years' time. Obviously, we need space for leisure. We need space for people to have a picnic and sunbathe. But can we balance that alongside the spaces where people can learn and engage with what a wilderness or a wilder nature would look like?
Let's go back to Stephen in 5 or 10 years' time. Perfect. Well, these next 2 weeks are going to be quite eventful.
Yeah.
Next episode, you hopefully will hear back planning permission from our Volunteers Day. And I'm sure there's other things that will happen between then and now as well. So until then, Chloe, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, just thank you everyone for listening. And I hope wherever you are and whatever you're doing, you're having a lovely time.